stress. The definition of stress is a nonspecific response of the body to any demand made on it. We all need some stress to function. The complete lack of stress would be death. There's stress all the time. However, some stressors can be positive or negative. So stress can be something that is something in the form of something that's very exciting, very pleasing to you. It still can have some of the same response or effects on the body. And things can also be negative. And we usually look at stress as being something that's negative, and it's not that. Stressors, or the things which cause stress in us, are personal, depending on the person's own perception of what things are threatening to them. Just examples that I was thinking of, I really get weirded out thinking about spiders and snakes. I have never been bit by either, but that's just something that I just can't tolerate. However, when somebody mentions bears and the fact that bears have been up on the tailings already this year, that doesn't bother me at all. I wouldn't feel at all uncomfortable going up near where they've been at night. They just don't cause a lot of stress. If my mother sends me in the mail a package in it, and I open it up and it's a pink shirt, that's a stressor for me. It may not be for you, but that's a stressor for me because I think of all the hassles that I've had with my mother trying to be myself without the without her desire to make me more quote-unquote ladylike and her perception of what a girl should be wearing. Okay, so, but if you got a pink blouse in the mail, you might love it. Okay. Yeah, right. Okay, so stress for one person is not necessarily the same that it might be for another person. When you cut yourself, that's a stressor to your body, but you more often have a local, what's called a local adaptation to that. Say for a cut, it probably turns red around the edge, it swells a little bit at that side, it hurts. There's some heat, or if there's an infection or inflammation reaction, that's a local reaction, and probably some decreased function of your skin in that spot. When you have stress, there's also a general adaptation reaction, and that's sort of what I have outlined here. The stressor is in the shadow up there at the top. And then the stressor, what it does to your body depends on your perception of it, okay? And then there are three things that happen. You have the alarm reaction one, alarm reaction two, and a rebound reaction or a resistance. And I'll talk about all those things. And then we have an intact body system or not, and we have the energy to deal with that stress or not. Okay, let's see. The alarm reaction one, and that's one thing that easy enough to cut out from the conference. They went into a lot of the physiology behind stress, what exactly happens in your body, all the different chemical reactions and things, and I don't think that would be very interesting or meaningful for you, so I'm going to skim over it quite briefly. But anyway, the first reaction is the alarm reaction one. That's fight or flight. You see, or I see the middle of the trail. I'm either going to look for a stick to beat it, or I'm going to get out of there. Fight or flight, it's called. And the different body responses with the expenditure of energy and defense in an emergency. And your pupils dilate, so you have a better ability to see. Your heart rate increases, and the force of the pumping of your heart increases. Your arteries that feed your heart muscle are dilated so that your heart muscle has more blood in order to beat harder. Your lungs, the little pouches in your lungs that accept air, they dilate to be able to accept more air so that you're going to have the oxygen and whatever that you need to either fight this thing off or run away from it. Okay, so these are the different kinds of things that are involved with the sympathetic response. Okay, yes?
Excuse me. The extra blood that's going to feed the heart and all that, mm-hmm. presumably that comes from my brain and decreases my powers of judgment. Yes? No?
No, not necessarily. You probably would... Your body's going to have to make some... set some priorities. You know, it's probably going to send more blood to your... It's going to cheat someplace, okay. Right? I don't know that it would necessarily cheat the brain. I mean...
Maybe it's just a mind.
It's usually surface, and that's why the expression white fright,
uh-huh.
because you
would lose it out of your fingers or whatever, yeah,
uh-huh.
cold.
Uh-huh.
And so it's going to go to your central organs, the ones, you know, that are most vital.
And okay. your big muscles.
Right, and large muscles, right. Right, okay. So that's the first response, or the alarm reaction. And this, the hormones involved with this are breaking down hormones. They're called catatoxic. They break down. I won't go into all the hormone things. But anyway, and the second response is the second alarm reaction. And this is a restorative reaction. It's by the parasympathetic nervous system. And this is concerned with conservation and restoration. And this, for quite a few of these things, it's going to do almost the opposite. It's going to constrict your pupils, probably. It's going to constrict the blood vessels that go to your heart. It's going to constrict your bronchioles. Okay, so this is sort of trying to balance things out. You need both of these reactions in order to function. But anyway, and this is on the way to the resistance or the parasympathetic rebound, which is this third thing over here. Okay, if you are always in the state between alarm reaction one and the second alarm reaction, and you never get into this resistance phase, that's going to be constantly grinding you on you. It's just like, it's like never getting any sleep. Because that's your rebound, that's your restorative, recuperative powers, okay? People who have chronic illnesses, for example, they're always in this stress side. They're always exerting that energy for that, okay? And it's very hard for them to get to the point where they can rebound, because their body is sort of constantly under attack. They're constantly under stress. Okay. One thing that I thought was very interesting, you have superficial adaptive power, which things like sleep, quiet music, exercise, these are all restorable. You can do them over and over again in order to relax or in order to gain back some of that energy that you need to fight. However, there's also deep adaptive power, and I don't understand. Well, I'm assuming that there have been studies done, or somehow that they know this or are pretty sure of it. And supposedly it's in your genes. Then it would be hereditary, and it's not restorable. People apparently run out of deep adaptive power. So I don't know. This might be something that you would. Yeah, you wonder sometimes, you know, how much do I have left? That's the first thing. That I do. Okay, but anyway.
Becky?
Yes.
I wonder, you know, you hear about people like in prison camps and that who mm-hmm. are just pushed here, there, and there, you know, and they do finally
get home.
Just run out.
Or yeah, yeah.
And you know they've they've lost their power to even. I've read where people who were initially very strong and
right.
who seem to be able to take a lot.
Right, right.
Finally, just seem like
right.
their resources are gone.
Right.
I wonder if that would be that.
It's possible, yes. And also, thinking here of the pretty high incidences of, well, you talk about the will to live, too. Something is, I think, in that. And you talk people who are finally subjected to nursing homes, old folks, and they've sort of taken away all their normal routines and normal things they identify with and function. And so often, people will die within the first year, even if they've been functioning fairly well on their own. It's just sort of losing the will to live, and that I think that's part of it. Okay. How do you know when someone is under stress? I mean, I was sort of doing it on purpose, but David came up to me just before dinner and said, "You really look worried about something." And I was sort of testing out. How do you know when somebody is under stress? Okay, grouchy. That might be possible. Okay, non-specific. These are non-specific responses to stress. A lot of people lose their appetite. Some people, I admit, gain their appetite, get hungrier. Okay. Decreased muscular strength, and this might be this type of thing, real sagging shoulders or whatever. Decreased ambition, just don't feel like doing anything. Weight loss, change in facial expression. Okay, by these things you can pretty much tell when somebody is under stress, and we respond to each other. This is the body language. There are some specific organ changes in your body in response to stress, and I was amazed to find out of stress-related diseases and found that enlargement of the adrenal cortex, that has to do with function. Shrinkage of the thymus gland, and the thymus gland is responsible for what are called T cells, autoimmune system. Your autoimmune system is what is your resistance system, antibodies and whatever. It helps you resist disease. And so the shrinkage of this gland that puts out those cells. Shrinkage of the lymph nodes, and your lymph nodes are also, they're filtering toxins and whatever. And also the appearance of ulcers in your intestines. I think that most people realize that ulcers that's probably the most commonly thought stress-related illness. And they were, at the conference, they were mentioning that somebody who had been to a very stressful session with another person had I don't know what kind of a session it was, but they were under a lot of stress because they had very strong feelings about something and they weren't able to get them out, or they weren't able to get them resolved. You know, went home and a few hours later they ended up with a bleeding ulcer or something. You know, they can happen very rapidly. Okay, so those are specific organ changes. And then, so it's important to understand the immediacy of this response. I want to do a little experiment, and I would like someone, a volunteer. No one is going to be made a fool of. That's the first thing I ask, because I volunteered for this session. I want somebody who thinks they're probably as strong as or stronger than I am.
Physically.
Come on, Judy. Well, it doesn't make any difference then. Anybody, pretty strong. Okay, Nadine.
Peter.
You're already in distress.
Okay. I want you to stand just right here so you can face. Now just put your arm out like this, or however it's comfortable. Now I'm going to press on your arm, and you try to resist the force of my strength on your arm.
Palm down?
Whatever's comfortable. You can do up if it feels like it would be more. Okay. Now you resist. Okay, pretty strong. Now I'm going to converse with her for a couple of minutes. Well, you know, it's draining. You know, it's something that's draining, and your body just chemically, yeah, you think when it's fight or flight, you know.
Yeah, that's the difference. Presumably the thing was emotionally calling her body resources to prepare for flight,
yeah,
or protection, right. But something that was just drained from mental strain.
Right. Right.
So there are different things.
Do you think you could react in that way if you thought it differently? If I thought of something more, less draining, something more that I would, like snakes or something, that I would intend to
do? Or do you think it would have been draining? Perceived it, you would.
Possibly, but then it's like you were called to remember something that perhaps wasn't threatening at the time. You know, I think that might be the difference. I'm not sure about that, but I just wanted to point out the speed with which your body or adjusts or whatever. Okay. In order to rebound and recover, you have to have three things. You have to have this intact body system. You need to be well then. You have to have energy, an energy source, and you have to have intact perceptual ability. There are variables that interfere with the normal process of adaption. And writing, I can find them. Okay. Point of interference. If the point of interference is at the perceptual level, it could be something like mental illness, drugs which change your perception, alcohol, whatever, tranquilizers, sleeping pills, things like this, that or like I said, mental illness, things that would change your perception. If the point of interference is at your energy level, it could be that would be something like being anemic or having difficulty getting enough oxygen. If the point of interference is at the level of the body systems, it could be something like heart disease or aneurysms or some other chronic disease. If the point of interference or a point of interference at the stage of alarm reaction 1 could be something like quadriplegia, okay, that just, you know, you're not going to be able to fight or flight if you can't run. Alarm reaction 2 would be adrenal cortical insufficiency, pituitary tumors, things that have to do with the hormones. And then at the stage of resistance, that's also hormonal things. These are things that can interfere with the adaption. Maladaption. When you aren't adapting, the process is the process of maladaption occurs in the presence of variables which interfere with or intensify the process of adaption. Okay, anything that interferes with your ability to adapt to something, or requires energy expenditure, usually results from abnormal mechanical functioning, say of the body, and without intervention, the process of maladaption ultimately leads to a stage of exhaustion. Okay, that's if you're not able to adapt in here, you're eventually going to be exhausted. Okay, and for my purposes, from the nursing standpoint or from your standpoint, if you realize that it's happening to you or happening to a friend or something that they can't adapt, you have to see when action is necessary in order to intercept this lack of progression or whatever to the rebound. Okay, when a person is misperceiving something, like for me, it doesn't do me any good to worry about snakes out here, especially in the winter, okay? But I'm not misperceiving it, but there are people, you know, that would be phobias, that might be an example. In the presence of the maladaption, we've talked about that. When available energy is compromised, when you don't have enough energy, when energy expenditure is excessive, you're burning up too much energy on it, when vital body organs are damaged or weakened, and when normal adaptive mechanisms are absent or compromised. Okay. This next section I found to be particularly interesting. We discuss premorbid personality types for diseases of civilization. And diseases of civilization are those diseases which they have found that are linked to our need to be civilized, to act in a civilized manner, what we expect of a civilized person. Okay, and those, the four diseases that were pointed out specifically were far be civilized. Heart disease, lung diseases, autoimmune diseases, and cancer is an auto, this comes under that category, and rheumatoid diseases like arthritis. And
does ulcers come under cancers?
Pardon me?
Does ulcers come under cancers?
No, I wouldn't think so.
That'd be autoimmune.
You think so?
No.
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I don't know that. But anyway, I wanted to go a little bit. I don't know. I think when I talk about these, I think everybody probably sees themselves a little bit, and I want you to recognize also that this is sort of on a continuum. There are very few people that are way on one end of the scale or the other. But perhaps all of us in certain areas are a little bit like this, and some more than others. And again, it's when these things are to the extreme that you are making yourself subject to the possibility of disease. How many people have heard of type A personality? Okay, there's type A, supposedly type A personality, and type B personality. Get my results. Okay, these type A personality or type A behavior is supposedly related as the premorbid personality type for heart diseases. And again, these personality changes or personality types, these things are occurring before the disease begins. The type A behavior is described as hurry sickness, where a person substitutes success for interpersonal relationships and trying to do many things at once, or success is defined in relation to numbers and how many things can be obtained in dollars and cents, whatever. Okay, type B, which would be the other side of the coin, or supposedly, is concerned with the person that is concerned for the feelings of self and others and concerned with interpersonal values. Okay, the premorbid personality type for cancer, one thing about this, we often have little cancer cells or mutant cells in our body. However, our bodies are capable of destroying them when we're healthy, but people with poor autoimmune systems can't fight these. And apparently, and we talked again about how stress alters your thymus gland and its ability to put out these autoimmune cells. Okay, premorbid personality type for cancer, the helpless, hopeless personality, that's in quotes. Having to do what other people want, or to find happiness in terms of pleasing others only, finding happiness outside of self. Then if the object of the person's love is removed soon, or and again this is an extreme, soon the possibility of cancer occurs. And there have been, when personality changes have occurred, or when people have seen spontaneous remissions in cancer, they've also noticed that the personality has changed, probably preceding that. The person's perception of the world changes. And these are supported by research at the Simonton Clinic, and I've got a bibliographic reference on that. I had a little bit of a hard time with this, because I wondered, Christianity, where does that come in here? If you're not to feel so concerned with pleasing others or whatever, won't people say, doesn't that mean that you're selfish or something? And I just looked up the definition of selfish today, and it's devoted to or caring only for oneself. And I think, that's an extreme type thing, and I don't think that one has to be selfish to be able to adapt or to not react in this way. Question?
You mentioned type A and type B. Mm-hmm. No one is really all one or the other.
Right, right. And I said it's a continuum, you know. But the people who are probably more prone to problems are way on, you know, way on the far, sort of off the deep end. We think of the successful businessman type.
What if
you
have heart disease and cancer?
You got problems, baby.
Look for smelling.
Oh, it's not, you know, it's not like you couldn't have a little bit of...
Yeah.
A little bit of each.
Yeah,
a little bit of all.
Imagine, yeah. Oh, go ahead. Okay. And then the third type that we discussed was the arthritis personality type, and they didn't say much about it, but just passive-aggressive is the personality type. Acting civilized or passive, but really wanting to be aggressive. And okay, so that's like, you know, you're tightening up your muscles, you're tense, you know, from this discrepancy between what you think is expected of you, but what you want to be. So when you, rheumatoid arthritis, that's a disease of your muscular skeletal system, your ability to move. And you can imagine this tightening up, what effect that could have, making stiff joints, whatever, from always being on the alert. Okay, here's the how-to section of my discussion. How to help yourself or to help someone else. The first thing that we talked that was discussed was being able to assess yourself. And Hans Selye was the first person who actually defined stress and did the initial research on that. And he was doing this in Czechoslovakia back in 1925. And he defected, apparently, to North America. I think he's in Canada now, before the war. And it hasn't been until the last 10 or 15 years that people have really gotten interested in the things that he's done. But anyway, he said, you must determine whether you are a racehorse or a turtle. And again, this is on a continuum, but a racehorse functions better under a high degree of stress. Or a turtle requiring peace, quiet, and tranquility. So a person who is a turtle who is being forced to or thinks it's expected of him that he must do everything at once, thinks a lot of demands on him, that they would be functioning under a high degree of stress. However, a person who is more on the racehorse end of the things, if he is knocked off his feet for some reason and can't do the things, can't stay busy, is somehow prevented from doing that, that's going to be as stressful for him as it would be for the other personality to have to speed up. So it's important to know what your level is. Okay. And I think people do know that too. I think I'm more on the turtle end too. I'm very good at procrastinating and all that. Okay, so you need to observe yourself. Check the indicators of self-stress, sleep habits, insomnia, your heart rate, body movement, these things. You can tell. Okay. And then tension, observing things of yourself. Do you do things that are fashionable or do you do the things that you really like to do? Tension shows early in your shoulders. You know, if you have someone relax and have them lift their arms, their arms are just sort of stay there and they just don't drop. You can tell early, or you can tell them how much tension is in the person. Okay, and you need to choose your own goals. In order to reduce stress maladaption, you need perhaps to change your perception of stressors. One of the ways to do that, habituation, was discussed. If you live next to a train track, some, I think Barb and Jack do, and and I do. Anyway, that's an in-joke, but I do, so I live up next to the loom room. But I've got, and above the, and above the laundry, and next to a hallway, and just right in from a stairway. I would never get any sleep or never get any rest if my mind was tuned in to those things all the time. It took a while for my mind to habituate those things so that I didn't see them as stressors most of the time. They still bug me once in a while. I was just thinking this evening, a little kid who sees his mother calling him in before he's ready as a stressor all the time, probably, you know, just tunes that out, you know, by the habituation of it. I didn't hear you, mother. Well, mother is sure that they would have, but child probably didn't, you know, at that point. So being so used to tuning that out, that's habituation. And habituation is a good thing in most instances, because it helps you by the number of times that you are exposed to that stressor, you know, after a while, being able to tune it out or not see it as something stressful.
Is the claim that is a perfectly efficient system, or is it just a pretty efficient system? Are those things still draining off some energy even though you're not aware that they're there?
I'm not sure about that. I think
it seems like it would be possible that they're draining off energy without you being aware of it.
Yeah.
Well, it depends if you're still seeing them as stressor. Well, like with me in the laundry room down below, that doesn't bother me at all anymore. It would take an awful lot of racket down there to upset me, you know. And it's a change. What?
It's a matter of degree.
Yeah, I think it would be too.
I think the reason why I ask that is sometimes, for instance, when I was in South Dakota, I'd read out in our kitchen sometimes, and our refrigerator is very, very noisy refrigerator. new ones are, they say.
Uh-huh.
And but I wouldn't hear the refrigerator. I'd be reading and I wouldn't hear it at all. But when it went off,
then you would notice it.
Then I just feel myself just relax. You know, I mean, I just feel my shoulders come down, and I go, oh my God, does that feel good to have that refrigerator on?
Uh-huh.
I wasn't aware of it until it stopped.
Right. Yeah, that's possible. No, I'm not.
The same thing as if you're riding a car, the noisy car, on a long trip.
And then the car stops.
I think those are good points, because I think our habituation mechanism can at times lead us down into very dangerous situations. That habituation is a quick response to stress that gets us through stress right now, but the long run effect might be very detrimental, and it drains on your that long-term pool of adaptation.
Probably, yeah.
And I think more and more evidence is coming to light having to do with noise pollution, non-total spectrum lighting, and food additives, a whole lot of stuff that we've adapted to and get along fine right now, but they're very debilitating in the long run.
Right. Yeah,
the other example of habituation, for example, people work in a very noisy atmosphere where it's actually harmful to the ears. Through habituation, get to where they tune it out, but the physiological damage to the hearing system continues, and you can actually find losing.
All right, and then, and again, how many times, you know, it's like, can you adapt 100 times, but then maybe 101 times, you know, the continuous thing. Okay, this is also in changing your perception. Being convinced that it's good to be assertive, and we talked quite extensively about this, but practicing being assertive, and I want to point out that being assertive is not being aggressive necessarily, and I think a lot of people see it as that, but being assertive is articulating your feelings in a reasonable manner. Articulate, to put into words, putting it into words even if it's only to yourself, what you need or what you see. Okay, articulating it. I feel this. Feelings are not good or bad. Feelings are. You feel. You know, there's no denying that. But being able to put them into words. In a reasonable manner. Not in an angry or irrational manner. That doesn't accomplish anything, too. And I those are the things that make it different from being aggressive. And then if you put it into words in a reasonable manner, it's at least you know yourself what your needs are, what you see or what you feel. And then when you think, you know, it's the tearing between what you see and feel and what you think others expect you to feel, whether others expect you to see or others what others expect you to do, and you could see how that would just be tearing on you all the time. But it's apparently very well, and I think it is. I feel like I get a lot of relief from being assertive, and people who know me know that I do. Another of these things as far as changing your perception, and that's helping right in here and being able to adapt, is meditation. And our lecturer said you don't need to pay $150 to the TM people to get your mantra to be able to meditate. Meditating is 20 minutes twice a day, tuning out all as many stressors as possible, and sort of putting yourself in neutral. And they found that meditating alters your perception even while you're not meditating. It has a cumulative effect. There's no need to change your religion. If you don't have time to do this, you apparently won't habituate as well. That's a quote. But this, the meditation is a focus of mental energy on an object, a neutral object, prefer, you know, one, an object or a thought or something that doesn't have a stressful implication for you. And again, this has to be something that is neutral for you. Like I said, a pink blouse wouldn't be neutral for me, but it might be for you. Okay, and practice 20 minutes twice a day. And we were talking about whether, you know, does prayer fall under that category, because we usually think of meditation in the Christian religion as being prayer. And I think it would depend on, I don't know, what does somebody else think about that? I think it would depend on what
prayer
thoughts
it's doing. Prayer would be stressful, I would think, if you're focusing in on those things that are bothering you,
mm-hmm.
so you're not tuning those out.
But I think this, I remember a thought that I had in relation to this. You know, so many times, prayer is something, that's talking to God all the time, talking to God. And I think, you know, the meditation is a listening process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tuning out all the other things that, so you can listen and get in touch with, you know, God talking to you. And so you know what you're...
Well, it's all a new definition of prayer and meditation. Mm-hmm. I mean, prayer can be that.
Right. Okay.
What I found helpful this weekend, I just came off of
that's right.
Weekend of silence and meditation. And I concentrated on some Bible passages. And I could just feel all the crap floating out and disappear.
Cathartic.
Yeah. And I think probably concentrating on any one thing would produce the same thing, the same relaxing kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. That was.
We used to do it with a hard-boiled egg.
It's pretty neutral.
That is a neutral thing.
Yeah. You just concentrate on the hard-boiled egg. You hold it in front of you, and you don't think of anything else but that.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a good place.
Did you get physical changes or like?
Oh yeah, it's very relaxing, just like a night's sleep.
When you were thinking about Bible
words. Yeah, or the
hard-boiled egg. Can you meditate if you're not sitting? I mean, can you meditate like walking or like that, or does your body
have
to be still?
Well, if you have to worry about running into something, I don't imagine you could. You're perceiving all the time. You're going to be constantly stimulated by things that are possible stressors. So, you know, I sort of wouldn't think that you would. But
like you're saying, you can't get in as deep a state of meditation.
Perhaps.
Certainly you could then.
Mm-hmm.
Turn off to something pleasant and concentrate
right.
And then walk.
Right.
Perhaps won't be as deep.
And again, they mentioned that this has a cumulative effect. I had a friend who I worked nights with in Seattle, and she used to be able to You know, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, that was the worst time, having very difficult time staying awake and maybe not a lot happening to stimulate us or worrying about how the morning was going to go, a change of shift and everything. And she used to meditate for about 20 minutes, and it was almost as though she'd had a complete night's sleep. You know, she'd just feel very, very relaxed and refreshed.
Becky, I wondered, I've also heard about a way, I forget, someone just mentioned this to me recently, that a way to meditate is to concentrate on sounds and sights that are right here. Sort of to go, instead of trying to withdraw
to block them
out, senses, to go to the senses totally and forget about, you know, judging the sound mm-hmm. or the sight or anything, but mm-hmm. simply just being very super aware of everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. as a possible way to do that. And now I have tried much of either, but I know that sometimes I've been in a place where there's a routine activity that I've done many, many times. And it's very routine, it's the same thing all the time. And sometimes I think I could do that and meditate to a certain extent. Partly, sometimes I'm not happy if I'm just sitting still.
For the rhythmicness?
Yeah, there was a kind of a motion.
The athletes talk about the and this was discussed too, the sort of the high that you get after you've run for a few miles, you know, where the stress of, you know, keeping going is sort of washed out of it, and somehow the rhythm of it or whatever takes over, and how it's supposedly a very enlightening.
I guess I would relate with that, you know, like when I, you know, whether it's jogging or a couple times I try just sort of sitting really blank and, you know, regular breathing and stuff. There's a physical kind of a release, whereas meditation spiritual for me is a real different thing. It's not necessarily, and it doesn't necessarily mean to, but it's not as much the physical relaxation, you know, where I feel just, you know,
right.
physically good, but it's more of a spiritual, emotional kind of a peaceful thing.
And which, but if it is a spirit, if it is an emotional thing, seeing how our body responds to emotional things, that is going to be a physical thing. I don't think it can help but be a physical thing.
But I mean, I'm just noticing my jogging is more.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There's a time, Pat was telling me one time there was somebody who complained about jogging. They didn't like to jog, and they just kind of, every time they did a lap, they would just kind of concentrate on you know, something different. I've started doing this, and like, you know, one lap I just will, you know, just kind of a prayer, I guess, and just thank, concentrating on one person in my life and all the things that I really had to be thankful for, knowing that person. I could run a mile and a half, you know, pretty soon, you know, just concentrating on that.
I used to do that running. I would pick letters for the day, and I would pray. I would thank God for everything that I could think of that began with that letter. It's weird, you know, but it's relaxing.
I think all my French friends doing that.
Right. Okay. And the second thing as far as how to reduce stress maladaption. Geez, I'm running out of adaptive energy. Is the need to increase the parasympathetic rebound, and that's right in here. Assertiveness again helps this, and also the need for normal, restful, non-drug altered sleep. People who are aging generally need less sleep. An early sign of stress is insomnia, and insomnia interferes with this rebound. Perception altering drugs also interfere with sleep patterns. Also, vigorous physical exercise falls under this, as far as helping to, and we just discussed that. It's very important. Aerobic exercise, also exercising your heart and lungs, and this is needed to be healthy. And of course, you should follow baseline medical advice for yourself as far as what you're capable of to begin with. But this vigorous physical exercise potentiates this parasympathetic rebound, and it's addictive. That's a quote. And this means working your heart to 80% of its capacity, 1 hour a day, 3 times a week. That's supposedly the minimum. Another thing that they talked about, if you're diseased for some reason and can't run, thinking of like a person in a hospital or something, they've done experiments with creative visualization, and this would be along the lines also, I imagine, of imagining or the meditation almost. And they talked about wiggling your fingers and toes for 5 minutes and then visualizing some fun exercise for 10 minutes and then doing that 3 times and then walk around a little bit, and that supposedly is very therapeutic and helps restore this.
Can you give a, can you describe 80% of capacity of the heart? How does it feel? Am I really strung out or what?
No, I don't think so.
Can you do it by walking fast, or do you have to run?
No, I think you could, but your heart's capacity is going to increase, so you probably would need to increase as your ability increased. Yes?
I'm not disputing your fact, but you have to do it for an hour?
Supposedly. An hour, what, 20 minutes?
10 or 15 minutes.
3 times a week?
5 times a week and then 3 times a week.
Would it be cumulative, 15 minutes a day?
Okay, just a minute. Judy?
I've heard that to get up to it, you have to do at least like, you know, every other day, but if you want to maintain a certain level, it's 3 times a week for 10 to 12 minutes.
Yeah, I suppose this is...
That's got to be really individual, and it's very different between men and women. Like Cooper in his aerobics book, he's the grand guru of aerobic training. Mm-hmm. He says 20 minutes 3 times a week, but that wouldn't be enough for me at all.
Well, it depends on how much you push your
heart. Well, okay, using a baseline of getting your heart up to 150 beats a minute. Now, I don't know how you can go across the board with people, because if your normal pulse rate is 120 beats,
then that would
and you're only raising it to 150, what kind of training effect mm-hmm. is that? But mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's one person's opinion. All right, I think that we've just about run out. That I'm amazed I actually managed to skim through that all. Go ahead.
You were talking about stress all the time. What's the difference between stress and distress?
I think distress is, it leans more towards the negative stressors. There's a book by Hans Selye, and it's the one for layperson. I have it. It's called Stress Without Distress. You're always going to be under stress, okay? You need stress to live. But without distress, meaning, I imagine distress is when you aren't able to adapt to it.
Or you're kind of talking about tonight, and it's kind of distress in a way.
Probably leaning more towards that, or showing what things are would cause distress.
I would say distress is, I don't know, it's really vague, but one form of stress.
I would call distress the negative side, and maybe not being able to adapt to the stressors that are more negative.
You might
negative.
Explain with just word usage. Distress is a people's term of something unpleasant. Stress is a very now is a real technical term referring to exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Especially stress is something that has a goal to get something done. It's got, like, pressure on it, but like stress is not the whole mm-hmm. thing.
It's probably quite a bit a matter of semantics.
Yeah,
and
okay.
One other thing that was interesting, probably some people have seen this. It's called the Social Readjustment Rating Scale, and these are things that life events, and they've given them a value. And death of the spouse has a mean value of 100, and it goes all the way down to minor violations of the law, which have a mean value of 11. And this might point out too. And these are all stressors. Supposedly. This is within 85% accuracy. They found that in a year, if you rate over 300, if you have a score of over 300 for that year, you may well get sick. If your score is over, okay, if it's over 500, you probably are it's possible within, again, 85% accuracy, up for a serious hospitalization. And if it's over 750, the illness could be life-threatening. But these things that are listed, they're not all negative things. Okay, changes in work hours or conditions, changes in resident, change in school, you know, Christmas holiday.
What does it say for stress? One of the highest point ones.
Pardon me?
Success can be one of the very high point items.
Sure.
You do something that you consider a very major success, mm-hmm. that can really rack on the points.
Sure.
What does Christmas say for Christmas holiday?
Oh, Christmas. And this is, it's a tradition-laden time and can be constraining. They give it 12 points. It might be more for you.
About 190.
Okay, thank you very much.